Oh, good afternoon, everyone. And I almost said good morning, but of course I just realised we've just slipped past the midday. Welcome to this morning's library seminar. My name is Jonathan Curtis and I'm Assistant Secretary Research Branch, as many of you know, in the Parliamentary Library. Anti-money laundering, counter-terrorism finance, otherwise known as AML-CTF, has been rather topical in the news in recent months. We've seen the controversy surrounding the Commonwealth Bank and the allegations of multiple breaches of its obligations under Australia's AML-CTF laws. These laws have been progressively implemented over probably decades now as key parts of efforts to control the flows of funds, illicit funds, first to organised crime groups, then terrorist groups, and more recently, I think, in relation to arms proliferation. Hopefully that's an accurate summation. Today's seminar will cover the international standards that apply to Australia and why they are important given Australia's risk profile and gaps in compliance. Liz Atkins, our speaker today, is a former Deputy CEO of AUSTRAC, Australia's AML-CTF agency, where she worked for 17 years with responsibilities in relation to most parts of the agency, but particularly including policy development and the international frameworks and legal frameworks. In the last 2 years, she's also been a member of the international teams assessing the AML-CTF regimes of both the USA and Denmark against the international standards set by the Financial Action Task Force, which is the Paris-based lead agency on this. A particularly experienced and well-credentialed speaker, and I'm delighted to have you here this morning, Liz. As usual, our speaker will present for about 30 minutes and then we'll move on to general discussion. I'll note, of course, that we're being recorded this morning and that will be available on the Parliamentary Library's website in due course. Please join me in welcoming Liz.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's lovely to be here. I've been talking to the people here before we started about the fact that it's a couple of years since I've even been inside Parliament House, so I'm very happy to return. As Jonathan said, I'm a former CEO of AUSTRAC, but in the last 2 years, I retired a couple of years ago, but in the last 2 years I have been involved in mutual evaluations of the USA and Denmark. So very much still in touch with the sort of policy framework and the international framework. Just one disclaimer before we even start, before we get to questions, I have no knowledge of what is happening at AUSTRAC around the Commonwealth Bank and indeed Tabcorp, who were the previous issues, so I can't answer specific questions when we get to questions. But let's talk about the background, the framework to the regime in Australia first, and then I'll talk about a bit about Australia's regime and where we hit the mark and where we don't hit the mark at the moment. As Jonathan mentioned, the Financial Action Task Force is the name of a task force which was originally created at the G7 summit in Paris in 1989. There are currently 25 member jurisdictions and two member regional organisations representing most major financial centres around the world. And there are two observer countries at the moment which are likely to become members. As well as the FATF itself, there are FATF-style regional bodies, FSRBs, which bring into the global network almost every country in the world, with the notable exceptions of Iran and the DPRK. In our region, it's the Asia-Pacific Group on Money Laundering, of which Australia is, not surprising, a lead member and indeed the permanent co-chair of that organisation. FATF includes a large number of observer organisations as well, such as the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, the OECD. FATF is actually aligned to the OECD rather than actually an OECD organisation. The UN, the World Customs Organisation, amongst others. FATF operates under a mandate from finance ministers, in our case that's the Treasurer, to develop policy and promote effective implementation of legal, regulatory and operational measures for combating money laundering, terrorism financing and emerging threats to the integrity of the financial system. And as Jonathan mentioned, that actually now includes financing of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction as well. The latest mandate was in 2012, and it endorsed the most recent standards and called on the FATF and the FSRBs to conduct peer reviews, which are called mutual evaluations, and monitor progress of countries through follow-up processes. Those reviews in the past mainly focused on technical compliance with the standards, but this latest round of evaluation also assesses effectiveness of regimes. Ministers also asked the Financial Action Task Force to continue to monitor for high-risk and non-cooperative countries and propose coordinated action, including countermeasures where that's appropriate. FATF was also asked to continue its work to improve transparency of legal persons, companies, and arrangements such as trusts, to focus on emerging issues such as financing of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and also to step up its support of global anti-corruption issues. In 2012, FATF revised the standards, which are known as the 40 recommendations, and also developed 11 what are known as immediate outcomes, under which the effectiveness of AML-CFT regimes can be assessed. You can find the full 40 recommendations and the methodology for assessing technical compliance and effectiveness on the FATF website. So the standards themselves are known as the 40 recommendations, and they cover a broad range of issues that relate to anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing. They were last revised in 2012. That process took several years, particularly because of the brand new methodology for assessing effectiveness. You can imagine, I mentioned there are 35 countries and quite a lot of member organisations and observers who are all involved in the process to draft the new recommendations. If you think working committees in Parliament is difficult, you should try working in a committee of 35 countries to try to reach agreement on standards that every country feels that they can actually implement at home. It's quite a process. Took several years, meetings all over the world. I think one 12 months, we had a meeting in a different country every month, so for 11 months of the year. So it was quite a difficult process. When people sort of look at the recommendations and wonder about some of the ways they're drafted, particularly, for instance, in relation to transparency of legal persons and particularly arrangements where you're trying to come to agreement between common law countries that have trusts, civil law countries that have some similar arrangements but not real and don't really understand them, then you might get some understanding of why some of the recommendations are quite awkwardly drafted and you wonder if anybody could ever meet them. The recommendations cover the need for national policies and national coordination based on a country's risk. So everything is looked at in the context of a specific country's risk and the way its financial system is set up and its the other political nuances of the country. We're all expected to assess our national risk of money laundering and terrorism financing, although this doesn't necessarily mean there's a single national risk assessment. Australia has done both a money laundering and a terrorism financing risk assessment on AUSTRAC's website and probably on AG's website. You'll find links to Money Laundering in Australia 2011 and Terrorism Financing in Australia 2014, which are the public versions, as well as a number of more specific risk assessments which AUSTRAC has done in relation to Australia's not-for-profit sector, our securities and derivatives sector, our financial planning sector, stored value cards and our superannuation sector. So the assessment of risk is intended to underpin the requirements of a country's regime. Enhanced or simplified measures are to be based on the national assessment of risk, although there are some measures which, particularly where FATF has already decided that they are of themselves high risk, there are some measures which are not risk-based. For instance, the measures relating to politically exposed persons from foreign countries. FATF sets some specific standards which every country is intended to implement there. The other non-risk-based requirements are the standards for money laundering and terrorism financing offences, which are actually based on other international treaties and conventions, provisions relating to the confiscation of the proceeds of crime, and targeted financial sanctions related to terrorism financing and proliferation financing, which are mostly based on the UN Security Council resolutions relating to those matters. A large part of the standards relates to the requirements for international financial institutions and what are referred to as designated non-financial businesses and professions. I'll explain what they are later, including requirements for risk assessments, anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing programs, customer due diligence and reporting of suspicious transactions, as well as countries basing their regimes on risk. Reporting entities are also to implement measures based on their individual entity risk, apart from those requirements which FATF sees as high risk and where there's no flexibility, for instance, as I mentioned, politically exposed persons and also correspondent banks. There are also standards that apply to competent authorities, that is, government authorities, both those supervising compliance with the preventive measures applicable to reporting entities, financial intelligence units and law enforcement and investigative authorities. There are standards that are intended to improve the transparency of legal persons and arrangements, both for governments and to assist reporting entities when carrying out customer due diligence. There are specific standards about international cooperation, including mutual legal assistance, extradition and other less formal means of cooperation. FATF recommendations require application of preventive measures by entities based on their activities. So while we talk about reporting entities and we can list financial institutions, the standards actually define financial institutions based on activities. So in other words, any natural or legal person which conducts as a business one or more of a list of activities or operations for or on behalf of a customer will be caught as a financial institution. So the activities that define financial institutions include acceptance of deposits, lending, money or value transfer services, issuing or managing means of payment such as credit cards, traveller's checks, money orders, electronic money, trading in securities and derivatives, investing, administering or managing funds on behalf of other persons, certain types of insurance and currency exchange. Designated non-financial businesses and professions include casinos, real estate agents, dealers in precious metals and gems, lawyers, notaries, other independent legal professionals, accountants, who I have managed to leave off that list, accountants, and trust and company service providers. Lawyers and accountants are caught when they prepare for or carry out transactions for customers concerning real estate, managing client money, securities or other assets, managing bank savings or securities accounts, creating, operating or managing companies, trusts or other legal persons or arrangements, and buying and selling of business entities. There are protections for lawyers in relation to legal professional privilege, and some countries also cover other high-value dealers other than dealers in precious metals and stones, so dealers in luxury cars, antiques, yachts, those sorts of things. Australia's regime. Australia passed out the AML-CFT Act in 2006. Prior to that, there was an act called the Financial Transaction Reports Act, which is still in effect for a very small number of businesses which aren't caught by the new act, notably lawyers who have to report cash transactions over $10,000, but that's the only way we catch them here at the moment. The Act took effect over a three-year period. It broadly applies the standards to financial institutions, casinos and other gaming entities, such as Tabcorp and operators of electronic gaming machines, so pubs and clubs, basically, over a certain number of machines. The Act had bipartisan support and was developed through a significant consultation process with industry. In fact, it was probably the broadest consultation process I've ever been involved with when developing legislation. Originally, consultation started intending to apply the legislation to all financial institutions and designated non-financial businesses and professions, but it quickly became clear that that wasn't going to be possible. So the Act was split into what was called two tranches. And the second tranche, which we've been talking about for a long time, still hasn't happened. There was a reasonably recent domestic review of the regime, which the Minister for Justice tabled on the 29th of April 2016, which deals with the question of second tranche entities. And at the end of last year and early this year, there was definitely a process going on of consultation on potential models for applying the regime to those businesses and professions. I am not sure where that is up to at the moment, as I am not a public servant, but the Attorney General's Department will be the place to address those questions. The 2006 Act applied new requirements about customer due diligence, AML-CFT programs and reporting, which went further than the Financial Transaction Reports Act. It introduced a clearly risk-based regime. Reporting entities have to have programs in place which must be based on their own risk that they might be used for money laundering or terrorism financing. So they must carry out a risk assessment, and then they must put in place measures to mitigate their own risks. Programs also include the requirement for a compliance officer, training and vetting of relevant staff, and requirements in relation to senior management approval. Entities have to identify their customers using independent, reliable documentation or data. In lower risk circumstances, this can be relatively simple. In higher risk circumstances, they have to conduct what's referred to as enhanced due diligence. And beneficial owners of companies and trusts must be identified. These requirements replaced what was a fairly simple requirement. You'll all probably remember what's referred to as the 100-point check. A lot of people still talk about that. Customer due diligence is a little different nowadays. Based on risk, your very basic stuff might be very similar to the 100-point check. The rest of it has changed. There are reporting requirements in Australia. The standards require reporting of suspicious transactions. In Australia, we have reporting of suspicious matters to AUSTRAC. But we also have reporting of large cash transactions. That's anything of $10,000 or above that is cash, and of international funds transfers. Australia's almost the only country in the world that has compulsory reporting of international funds transfer instructions of any value. So there's no threshold in relation to international funds transfers. And there's also reporting at the border of where you're carrying $10,000 or more in cash, either into or out of the country, no matter what currency you're carrying it in. And there's a requirement if you're asked by a customs officer or a federal police officer, if you are carrying something referred to as bearer negotiable instruments, Travellers checks, checks, those sorts of things. If you're asked if you're carrying those, you have to declare those as well. AUSTRAC then uses that information to conduct analysis, which it provides to agencies designated in the legislation. Those agencies include the Federal Police, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, State and Territory Police and Crime Integrity and Corruption Commissions, ASIO, ASIS, all of the other security intelligence agencies, the Tax Office. The Tax Office is probably the biggest user of AUSTRAC information. State and Territory Revenue Authorities, Royal Commissions, the Australian Commission on Law Enforcement Integrity, ASIC, APRA, the ACCC, the Clean Energy Regulator, the Attorney General's Department, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, the Immigration Department, which of course includes Border Force or the old Customs Agency, and Treasury in their role as the Foreign Investments Review Board. That's why Treasury's there. Most of those agencies have direct access to the AUSTRAC database, so for checking, for alerts, those sorts of things. But AUSTRAC also performs more complex analysis, which might be relevant to an ongoing investigation or might be the trigger for a new investigation. AUSTRAC also develops trends documents, typologies documents, and other documents that are useful both to law enforcement and to entities that need to implement the legislation. As well as the reports from industry, AUSTRAC also has access to information from other law enforcement agencies and security intelligence agencies, and works closely with other agencies as part of task forces, investigative teams, and those sorts of things. So, Australian effectiveness. FATF's mutual evaluations include assessment against 11 immediate outcomes, as I've already mentioned. Australia was assessed in 2015 against those standards and the effectiveness outcomes. So here I have our results on effectiveness. We have varied results on technical compliance as well. But effectiveness is probably...
Can we just ask what the scale of the...
Okay, so yeah. It goes from high is the best to substantial, moderate and low.
Yeah, sorry for thinking
of that. That's right. As you can see, we got no lows, but several moderates. One issue for Australia was that when we were evaluated, we were very early in the new round of processes. I think we were country number 4 or 5 to be evaluated. So very early, as compared, for instance, to New Zealand, who are going to be assessed in 2020 and so are actually doing a lot of work to see where their gaps are and where they can fix it. What I will talk about is where we were found to be below substantial, so where we had moderate results. In relation to supervision, our issues were around the way that AUSTRAC assesses reporting entity risk. AUSTRAC is the supervisor of financial institutions and other businesses and professions in relation to AML-CFT matters. So there were concerns about whether AUSTRAC's report approach at that time was nuanced enough in relation to entities, particularly those that formed parts of large groups, and also the lack of sanctions against reporting entities. In relation to sanctions, the assessors were also concerned that the sanctions that had been applied were mainly enforceable undertakings, which is really an agreement by a reporting entity to fix the problems that they have. The assessors concluded that the use of those sanctions had minimal impact on ensuring compliance amongst reporting entities that weren't actually directly affected by the sanctions. And we were heavily criticised around our lack of appropriate supervision of higher risk designated non-financial businesses and professions because they're not caught. Assessors concluded that authorities were not able to demonstrate that AML-CFT compliance was improving, nor that we were discouraging criminal abuse of the financial and designated non-financial businesses and professional sectors. One of the issues is if you can't point to big sanctions, then international bodies like FATF can't see that there's any effectiveness. I mean, we're now in a very different position with the action against Tabcorp last year and now obviously the Commonwealth Bank action. The other moderate findings were in relation to preventive measures. The assessors found that while major reporting entities and those higher risk entities that were subject to more regular supervisory engagement from AUSTRAC had a reasonable understanding of their risks, because we're not fully technically compliant, reporting entities weren't able to demonstrate that they were effectively managing their risks. And entities that weren't closely supervised also didn't appear to be able to demonstrate that they were well aware of their risk and managing it. Certain amendments to the AML-CFT rules were in transition at the time of the assessment to bring them more into line with the standards. And we were also criticised for placing so much reliance on our banking and financial sector as gatekeepers, rather than focusing on some of the other high-risk gatekeepers such as lawyers, accountants, real estate agents and trust and company service providers. And this is probably even more of a focus now in that we've had things like the Panama Papers that point very clearly to the use of complex company and other legal arrangements to disguise illicit funds, whether it's in the case of organised crime or corruption. So the lack of requirements on DNFBPs, as well as the other factors around some financial institutions not clearly understanding their risks, calls into effect, question the effectiveness of preventive measures in the financial system as a whole. In relation to legal persons and arrangements, so companies and trusts, while Australia has implemented some measures to address the specific risks which were identified in the 2011 National Threat Assessment, other measures do need to be taken, including imposing obligations on those who create and register companies and trusts to strengthen the collection and availability of beneficial ownership information. The existing measures and mechanisms concerning such people are not sufficient to ensure that accurate and up-to-date information on beneficial owners is available in a timely manner to reporting entities or to law enforcement agencies. And it's not clear that information held on legal persons and arrangements is accurate and up-to-date. Australian authorities weren't able to provide evidence that they apply effective sanctions against persons who do not comply with the information requirements relating to beneficial owners. And overall in this country, at the time of the assessment, legal persons and arrangements remained very attractive for criminals for misuse. In relation to money laundering investigation and prosecution, the criticism there was that the focus remains very heavily on what are referred to as predicate offences. So the offences that are committed in order to earn the illicit funds which are then laundered. Australia, like many common law countries, focuses far more on those offences, the recovery of the proceeds of crime and the disruption of criminal activity, rather than specifically pursuing convictions for money laundering offences. This was a criticism levelled at both the Commonwealth and the federal state, the state and territory levels. In relation to confiscation, our framework was praised as being comprehensive. However, we were criticised for only confiscating relatively modest amounts, which assessors felt meant that criminals were basically retaining most of their profits. Has to be said, though, that the criminal assets confiscation team was at a relatively early stage at that point and was described as showing early promise, and confiscation amounts have increased since that time. In relation to terrorism financing preventive measures and sanctions, again, we were praised for having a strong and robustly administered system for targeted financial sanctions under the United Nations Security Council resolutions. But at that point in time, the private sector was not supervised for compliance with targeted financial sanctions, and we were unable to demonstrate that the legal framework was effectively implemented. We also lacked statistics around phrasing, financial supervision, supervisory experience and feedback, so it was a bit difficult to show that we were effective. And also at the time we had some serious weaknesses relating to the not-for-profit sector, including a lack of terrorism finance-related outreach and monitoring. Our biggest technical gap was and remains the lack of coverage of designated non-financial businesses and professions other than casinos and bullion dealers. Lawyers, accountants, trust and company service providers, and to a lesser extent real estate agents are seen by the FATF as important gatekeepers to the financial sector, and in Australia's own risk assessments confirm that, particularly in relation to activities such as the creation of complex corporate structures, which can be used to disguise both the source of funds and the ultimate beneficial ownership of funds. As I mentioned before, the review of the Act, which dealt with a great many of these issues, including scope of the Act, was tabled on the 29th of April 2016, and there has been industry consultation through papers on general reforms and sector-specific models for regulation. They're all available on the Attorney-General's Department website, including a project plan which covers two phases of reforms to be completed by 2019. Cost-benefit analysis for the second tranche was to be completed by June 2017, but I don't know whether that's in fact happened. Again, that's a question for the Attorney-General's Department. That's the end of my formal presentation. Happy to take questions, comments.
Thanks very much, Liz. While people are thinking about questions, perhaps I can lead off. Under the existing regime, are there any... the international regime... Are there any sort of substantial gaps around, for example, I've heard a lot about the hawala systems, the informal money transfer systems that operate, as I understand it, at an almost cultural level. The other one, perhaps at the opposite end of the technology spectrum, might be the Bitcoin kind of things. How much is that? How much is FATF looking at those two sorts of issues?
Technically, hawala systems are caught by the standards and indeed caught by Australia's regime because they refer to transfer of value, which is what a hawala system does. For those of you who don't know what a hawala system is, that's a name from a particular ethnic group, obviously, and there are various other names for this, but it's... a system whereby you might go to somebody in this country, you want to get money to your relatives in Iran, say, rather than transferring money between bank accounts or using your traditional remittance providers such as Western Union, that person, because it's so difficult perhaps to get money to those countries, that person will accept money here. They'll have a counterpart in Iran, and they will have systems whereby they can make sure that value money is provided to those your relatives in Iran, say, without necessarily having to transfer money directly through any of the traditional systems and then they'll balance their books in various ways at various times. So at no point might money actually move between the person in Australia and the person in Iran. But those formal, informal systems are caught as well. FATF over the years has done a lot of work around the risks, around how you might catch those systems. Some of the results have perhaps, you know, been some of the results of some of the things that have happened with remittance systems, say in Australia, where for a while there we were seeing our banks what they called de-risking, which was refusing to have remittance agencies as customers. One of the concerns there was that we were pushing people towards those hawala systems where we couldn't see them because they're underground. You'll find on the FATF website various documents about risks relating to hawala. There's a lot of work done around what are the things that you look for that might tell a bank or others that they're dealing with a hawala system. One of the ways AUSTRAC often finds out is through Dobbins. Their competitors will report them to AUSTRAC for not being registered and that sort of thing. So there are certainly, you'll find gaps in countries around that just because those things are very difficult to find. Technically, they're covered. Bitcoin, I'm not sure where we're at with Bitcoin here. Certainly, electronic currencies, FATF recommendations can apply to them. Some countries have brought Bitcoin in. It depends on how you define it. In this country, I know the Bitcoin Association, very anxious to be brought within the scheme to give themselves credibility within the financial system and that sort of thing. I am not sure where that is up to here. The Act as it stood didn't apply to them, but they were anxious to be brought within. I'm not sure what's actually happening there. Yep.
Thanks for an interesting presentation. Hearing that you don't know the details of the AUSTRAC, the CBA specifically, I'd still like to run a scenario. The Treasurer, and again, it's not a political question either, the Treasurer announced in relation to the CBA allegations and court case that APRA would conduct an inquiry. In the context that perhaps this was a call for a Royal Commission. The terms of reference included looking at groups, organisational structure, governance, financial objectives, remuneration and accountability. And my neighbour's actually a former AUSTRAC investigator, and he said, well, isn't that APRA's job? From a FATF understanding of the regulatory body, is that a fair or a accurate presentation? Is there a better way or another way that could have been or should be perhaps investigated from your understanding of the framework?
So I guess there are two issues there. One is the investigation of breaches of the Act, which is clearly the AUSTRAC as the regulator's role, and AUSTRAC has done that and brought action.
Yes.
In relation to the governance and other cultural issues that may or may not exist. I make no comment about that. Yes, it is clearly APRA's role. FATF recommendations the standards don't have anything to do with that. But I would have thought, yes, it's a matter for APRA how they investigate that and if they choose to have, I'm not an expert in what APRA's legislation says they can and can't do, but ultimately I guess it's APRA's choice as to what is the best way to investigate what that broader question of issues in the Commonwealth Bank. So as a personal opinion, I don't see any issue with the way they've set up the independent inquiry.
No, okay, that's good, thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry. Good question. Yes, you first, and then Jeff.
Apologies, I missed the first part of your talk. Could you just... I did hear you talk about the lack of requirements for lawyers, accountants, real estate agents, and it's a matter of some interest to me. Could you just tease out a little more and perhaps describe, for those of us not expert in the area, what are the actual risks, what's the evidence that there's a problem in Australia, because there is a cost-benefit issue there, obviously, and what's the sort of approach in other jurisdictions? Because it seems to have been talked about for 10, 11, 12 years, but not much has happened.
11 years, I think. Longer, because we probably started the discussions around the 2006 Act somewhere back in, maybe it was in 2003, I can't remember now.
Yeah, particularly the real estate agents, you said that wasn't as serious perhaps as the others.
Okay. It's in terms of being gatekeepers to the system. The risks, probably the biggest risks in relation to lawyers, accountants, trust and company service providers, are around the creation of complex legal structures. But as you... Were you here when I talked about the what the requirements were when lawyers and others were covered? It's only in particular circumstances. And it's when you're... Basically, it's when you're setting up or managing companies, trusts, other types of arrangements, when you're managing bank savings or securities accounts, managing client money, securities or other assets, or carrying out transactions concerning real estate. Yes, it's a narrow area of transactions where they are caught, but particularly if you have a look at things like the Panama Papers, it's a very significant area where they can act as gatekeepers to the financial system, if you like. And particularly in those areas where we have trouble identifying things like the ultimate beneficial owners of companies and legal arrangements, then it's important that those people have requirements upon them to properly identify and keep records and report. In terms of, as I mentioned right at the end, a cost-benefit analysis is being done. There obviously has to be something around that. In other countries, one of the things... different countries have done this in different ways. Many, many, many countries still have gaps in relation to this. Countries such as the European Union have just put straight into their money laundering directives the requirements on these sort of businesses. I guess the interesting country for us to look at is New Zealand, where they have just recently, just in the last 4 weeks, passed legislation that covers what they refer to as their phase two entities. It is possible to nuance your application of the legislation to different entities. You know, it's not necessarily the case that you would apply the AML CFT Act as it is now to, for instance, lawyers or real estate agents. So I think you do have to take my personal view is you have to take a nuanced view to it and yes, find ways that don't necessarily, in the end, completely meet the FATF standards, provided your risk justifies that. The New Zealand stuff is quite interesting. I'm doing some work with New Zealand at the moment around their mutual evaluation and preparing for it, so it's I can use them as an example. But obviously it's very, very relevant to us, the New Zealand example. They put their act has been passed. It transitions into force over the next couple of years. So obviously they're still looking at absolute specifics about how their requirements will apply to different entities.
Yeah. Two short ones. You mentioned something like exposed political figures. What are they? And secondly, you also mentioned the complex corporate arrangements and ultimate beneficiaries. How much access do you have to British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, and to what degree are there domestic arrangements an obstacle to what you're trying to do?
Okay, politically exposed persons are individuals. The definition is individuals who are or have been entrusted with prominent public functions. First of all, by a foreign country, there are distinctions between foreign and domestic PEPs. For example, heads of state or of government, senior politicians, senior government, judicial or military officials, senior executives of state-owned corporations, or important political party officials. FATF has some very strict requirements over what countries are supposed to do in relation to foreign PEPs. It's a higher level of customer due diligence that's supposed to be applied to them. Then there are the equivalent domestic politically exposed persons. So it's the same definition, just our homegrown ones. There a more risk-based approach is taken. So countries will apply their own... will apply the requirements on a risk-based approach, whereas foreign, it's an absolute, you've got a foreign PEP, you have to do this. Then there are also these days persons who've been entrusted with a prominent function by an international organisation, so the UN, the IMF, OECD. So that's what a politically exposed person is. You were asking about countries which have...
Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, where a lot of, say, corporate bodies from Hong Kong will be ultimately registered.
Yeah. Look, I mean, so there are ways of dealing with that. I mean, the biggest issue is really for reporting entities who need to identify who their customers are and trace it back. If the customer won't divulge, if the customer's going to divulge, that's not a problem. In terms of law enforcement, I mean, some of those countries there are arrangements with, but obviously there are going to be issues around getting hold of information about being able to ascertain, you know, who ultimately owns a company. Things are changing. I guess the Panama Papers were sort of the big issue for a lot of countries, which realised that in concert with some of those other countries, that, again, New Zealand, realised that they had structures in place that were allowed people to set up companies and trusts in New Zealand, which included structures with then, you know, Cayman Islands or wherever else, so other countries have made changes. So I guess the point is that, you know, the more countries put into place regimes that require you to divulge who your ultimate beneficial owner is, the more we can overcome the issues with having those regimes that exist.
Certainly a country that's internationally regarded as the exemplar, the model of absolute best compliance?
Okay. So the whole point of mutual evaluations is that a report is published and that people can then... countries can look and see what other countries are doing. The reports that have been done so far... and Ireland's only came out this week, so I haven't actually looked at that one. Spain and Italy have actually come up best. But really what you have to do is look across all of the reports to look at, you know, for instance, Australia's got a high on international cooperation. So obviously we are an exemplar for cooperating internationally around these particular issues. So you need to look across the reports. I'm not sure that anybody would sort of say this is the country we have to follow. For instance, I mean, one of the issues for us is Spain and Italy are civil law countries. We can't enact things in the same way as a civil law country can. It becomes one of the issues sometimes in FATF. You have the civil law countries and the common law countries, and there are just times when, you know, it's like you're talking a different language. Because the way the laws are structured are different. That's why, as I said, some of the, particularly the, if you look at the recommendation around trusts and other legal arrangements, it's very complex, because what we've tried to do is allow for common law countries not having specific legislation that covers all aspects of trusts. We're actually not convinced it works. We're not sure that a common law country can actually meet that those requirements, whereas the civil law countries just don't understand why we can't.
Any other questions? Well, I think on that basis, we might wrap up. Thank you all very much for coming. And thank you very much, Liz, for the presentation.
Pleasure.
Very, very interesting. Please join me in thanking Liz.